Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Happy Halloween as well. Partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature around 84. Then for tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 60. Sunny, a little bit cooler tomorrow with a high of 81. And then by later this week, there is a slight chance for thunderstorms. That comes our way on Thursday. Currently, relative humidity is at 30%. It's cloudy and 82 degrees here in Phoenix. Arizona's minimum wage is 80 cents higher than the wage required by the federal government, but some say it's not enough. If voters approve Proposition 206, the state's minimum wage would gradually increase from $8.05 an hour to $12 an hour by 2020. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on two employers with different perspectives on the initiative.
Another layer of government, that's the way I look at it.
Freddie Renstrom doesn't like being told how much to pay employees at his Phoenix-based catering company. He says his lowest starting salary is $9.50 an hour.
In my company, they have the ability to make more. They have the ability to do better. And I'd rather people have that, not just like, oh, I'm walking the door, I get this much money, and another year I get this much money, another year I get that much money.
Like Renstrom, Bob Summers starts his employees above the minimum wage. But unlike the caterer, the co-founder of Changing Hands Bookstores supports Prop 206.
Over the years, as we've increased minimum wages and increased benefits for our employees, we found ways of increasing our sales or decreasing other expenses.
$17.99. Because publishers set book prices, Summer says they can't raise them. But Renstrom says if Prop 206 passes, most consumers will pay more.
You think, you know, corporate America is just going to sit back and go, oh, we're just going to eat these wage increases. They're not going to do that.
Opponents have said Prop 206 might force some companies to cut back on hiring or even go out of business. Summer says that argument was debunked in 2007 after voters approved a smoking ban that included restaurants and bars.
All the bars are still there and more are opening every day.
A study released this month by the nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute finds a $12 minimum wage would give raises to about 800,000 Arizonans. It also says it would cost 13,000 jobs and result in price increases between 0.5% and 1.5%. The study also cites the Congressional Budget Office that found the benefits of higher wages exceed the costs. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A number of polls show voters enthusiastically supporting the passage of Prop 206 by double digits. That plus successful fundraising has led leaders of the PRO campaign to dole out money to defeat some Republican lawmakers. Prop 206 campaign manager Bill Scheel says voters should know the kinds of legislators he feels would move to undercut the initiative if it passes.
We think it's important that voters know which legislative candidates are supportive of Prop 206 and which legislators are likely to attempt to try to undermine the will of the voters.
Initiative opponent Garrick Taylor of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry says big donations by national groups coupled with spending on the candidate races shows there's an alternative agenda.
It's now become apparent that Proposition 206 is just one element of a bigger play by labor in Arizona this cycle to make the state more hostile to job creators.
But that point has not convinced national business groups to contribute money to defeat Prop 206. How uncommon is it for managers of a ballot initiative campaign to put money into other races? Veteran campaign consultant Chuck Coughlin is president and CEO of the Phoenix-based High Ground. And Chuck, how unique is this?
So they've made a pretty unusual decision, but I think tactically smart, to deploy resources to support candidates who support their efforts in legislative races. And they seem to be spending quite a bit of money in Pinal County, which is a potentially swing legislative district, to support candidates that are more supportive of their agenda.
So, Chuck, is there another issue coming down the pike that might be 2 years away, 4 years away, crystal ball-wise, that there would make even more sense for them to have more advocates?
Yeah, there's a bunch of issues. There's sentencing reform discussions coming up as it regards private prisons and the use of monies to either build additional prison facilities and or more treatment programs and trying to keep people out of those high-cost, high-security places where there is limited threat to the public and more rehabilitative services. There's other issues as it regards to financing on the state. The last couple of years, you've seen an aggressive effort on behalf of the legislature to usurp and sometimes step into places that local governments have traditionally held sway, zoning issues and those types of things.
Are we seeing more of a disconnect between lawmakers and the general public? Because I think if we think about it, a majority of lawmakers, as the body stands right now, would be opposed to raising the minimum wage, and yet looks like an overwhelming majority of Arizona voters want that.
It's clear that, that's happened. And, you know, majority of the legislature gets elected in primaries. I think there's only about four or five swing seats in the legislature. So most of the races are done, both Democrat and Republican, in the primary. When we do polling across the state on approval of governments, do you approve or disapprove, and then we get an intensity on that, we find much higher approval ratings for local governments that are nonpartisan or open elections, what we call them. Is if you want to run, go ahead and run. Everybody runs, and then the best two people run off in the election. And as we see, Steve, there's vast, growing part of the electorate is dissatisfied with the partisan nature. A lot more and more people, particularly younger voters, don't identify with one party or the other. They just want to see problems get solved.
Chuck Coughlin is president and CEO of High Ground. More than 721,000 early ballots have been signed and mailed into the Maricopa County Recorder's Office since early voting began 2.5 weeks ago. After the county's tabulation machines passed a state-mandated accuracy test Friday, officials are now beginning to actually count those votes. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, that test is one of a string of security measures the county goes through to ensure that each vote cast will be accurately counted.
It's a dry run of sorts for Maricopa County elections officials, and the ballot tabulation center in downtown Phoenix is buzzing.
This is the logic and accuracy test.
Maricopa County Recorder Helen Purcell explains what we're hearing right now are mock mail-in ballots being sucked in and scanned through one of the county's 9 tabulation machines. The Arizona Secretary of State's office is here too, and they already know what the results should be.
And the results that come off the machines have to match what they have pre-marked.
If they don't, officials have to determine why the discrepancy occurred and fix it. State law requires all voting equipment from each county to pass one of these accuracy tests before the general election.
We want the public to be confident that their vote, if it should have counted, counted. If it shouldn't have counted, it didn't.
That's Karen Osborne.
And I'm the Director of Elections for Maricopa County.
Osborne has been involved in Arizona's elections in some form since the 1970s. She says the process has evolved a lot since then, especially in the last 15 to 20 years.
It's no longer just transporting ballots from point A to point B with only the security of two people. Now it is multiple people doing multiple jobs, and then each one has to prove the other correct.
Take in-person voting next Tuesday, for example. After making your selection, your ballot gets scanned through what's known as an insight machine. That records and tallies your vote in a memory pack. It also saves the paper ballot as a backup. At the end of the night, those will be transported by separate teams to one of 20 ballot substations. Along for that ride is someone from the county recorder's office.
And usually we have two poll workers come from different parties.
Maricopa County Recorder's Office spokesperson Elizabeth Bartholomew explains each subsite must get the ballots, the memory packs, and the electronic poll sign-in book from each of their assigned polling places before they can head downtown and into the glass-enclosed tabulation center.
Everything is run in that room. Nothing is run at the polls, at the polling places. Nothing is run through Wi-Fi, through internet. And so that way, these votes are the most secure they can possibly be.
Poll sign-in books must match the number of votes cast at a precinct. And the state takes it one step further. Each county must also hand count 2% of the precincts for one final accuracy check. If you mailed in your ballot, well, it too has passed through several layers of audits before it reaches those scanners we heard a few minutes ago. The rooms where they're prepped for tabulation are also under 24-hour video surveillance that can be viewed by the public online. So what do all of these elections officials have to say about statements like this by presidential candidate Donald Trump?
Remember, we're competing in a rigged election. This is a rigged election, folks, okay?
County Elections Director Karen Osborne says it's simply not true in Arizona.
There are so many checks and balances on this system that it continues to prove itself on a daily basis.
Back at the Ballot Tabulation Center in Phoenix, the accuracy test has just wrapped up. Janine Petty is with the Arizona Secretary of State's office. She says Maricopa County has passed.
The results that we had matched what the results came out of the machine, so we signed off. Everything is good.
Which means from now until Election Day, this room will be filled with the near-constant buzz of early ballot scanning. Those initial results will be released after the polls close on November 8th. Harry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Surrogates for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have been making frequent appearances in Arizona in recent weeks, including Donald Trump Jr., First Lady Michelle Obama, and the vice presidential nominees. But yesterday saw a stand-in with deep Arizona connections, former Governor Janet Napolitano, who was here on behalf of Clinton. Napolitano was popular in the state, easily winning re-election in 2006. But when she left for the Obama administration, Jan Brewer became governor, leading to the passage of some legislation, including SB 1070, that deeply bothered many Democrats. So how significant a figure is Janet Napolitano here now? With me to talk about that is Mario Diaz of Mario E. Diaz and Associates. For a time, he worked for Napolitano. Mario, first of all, let me get your impressions of the significance or insignificance, however you see it, of Janet Napolitano coming back. I know she was here in part for Governor Mofford's memorial, but she was also here to stump for Hillary Clinton. What do you make of that?
Well, it's always good to see Secretary Napolitano back in Arizona, and she contributed so much for the moving forward of the state that visiting friends again was a good move for the campaign. Janet is still beloved here.
Have people forgiven her, I put that in air quotes, for leaving for a good job with the Obama administration, but her departure, many will say that led to the passage and signing of SB 1070, for example.
You know, with so much going on with this presidential election, I don't think that voters are delving into Napolitano's background that deep. I really do think that for a specific niche of voters seeing Napolitano back in Arizona and advocating and asking for support for the secretary is a smart move. Remember, Napolitano won the first governor's race because of moderate Republican women. And that's what trend seemed to be dictating, that moderate Republican women are heading for Secretary Clinton. And so having Napolitano reinforce that vote is a good move.
And Mario, how much juice do you think she still has here in the state in terms of the accomplishments that she had here directly? Is she better known now for having been Homeland Security Secretary than for being governor?
Well, look, I think after having Jan Brewer as governor for however long we had her in this state, it's refreshing to have someone like Napolitano back in Arizona to visit. I really don't think, Steve, that people are digging that deep in history of Arizona politics. They're looking forward to next Tuesday, and having Napolitano as a surrogate for the secretary is refreshing.
Again, I keep coming back to SB 1070, but that was something that was cited that wouldn't have gone through if Janet Napolitano had stayed here. Do some Latino voters kind of roll their eyes, the fact that they look at her in any way like that?
Look, I'm not speaking for the entire Latino community, but I can tell you this, that Napolitano was not the one who advocated for SB 1070. She wasn't the one that passed the 1070. She wasn't the one that signed SB 1070. What happened as a result of her wanting to serve our nation as Homeland Security Secretary should not have any effect at all on history of what happened after she left.
Mario Diaz of Mario E. Diaz and Associates. Mario, thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. I'm Steve Goldstein. In the world right now, there is a conflict seemingly immune to diplomacy, where high-level government ministers are powerless in the face of an enemy they can't even speak to. It's climate change.
Le désert avance à grands pas. The desert is advancing rapidly. The sand dunes shift, and they invade our agricultural lands. We lose about 104,000 hectares per year.
That's Adamu Chaifu, Niger's Minister of Environment. He seeks a compromise with a hostile environment that appears to want to swallow up his entire country. This is an excerpt from the National Geographic series, Years of Living Dangerously. The Niger predicament makes the job of correspondent Tom Friedman far more challenging than his reporting on the diplomatic nuances in a conflicted world as veteran columnist for the New York Times. Friedman's first book, you may recall, From Beirut to Jerusalem, brilliantly illustrated the contrasts in the Middle East. But as a correspondent for this National Geographic program, Friedman journeyed from the Paris Summit on Climate Change to Africa's Sahel Desert and saw the uncompromising reality. Can the folks in Paris have an impact? Can our conversation here have an impact on what's going on in the Sahel? Because that's really what it's going to take.
Yeah, there's no question. We can. It's not going to be immediate. The situation there is so much farther gone than people realize. For instance, John, you know, what was the Paris Agreement about? It was about preventing at maximum a 2-degree rise in global average temperature since the Industrial Revolution. Senegal's already there. They're actually heading for 4 degrees. Hmm. That will make these countries unlivable. And the trickle of migration you see now, and that trickle is no small trickle. We're talking about 9,000 to 10,000 a month coming from around West Africa into Libya, trying to get into Europe. It will turn into a flood.
So let's listen to part of the interaction that you captured in this documentary. This is a scene from season 2, episode 1 of Years of Living Dangerously.
What these guys are doing is wrong.
I mean, these are people who have been laid off by the extreme actions of the commissioners that are inside this building. They've eliminated these jobs and the jobs of thousands of other people across the state.
We want freedom! We want freedom! We want freedom!
Now, that's a highly produced moment of people yearning for freedom and demanding freedom. Can they demand that freedom in this environment where environmental factors are out of control of traditional political institutions?
Well, you frame the question, I think, exactly right, John. Man forgives. Mother Nature doesn't forgive. She has no heart, no soul. And the forces that we as human beings have unleashed will require extraordinary human action and collaboration to tame. Now, you can say, well, what is this? You know, maybe it's for the far-off, distant future. You know, let me just remind our listeners of something. You know, Barack Obama, when he took over his second term, agreed with Republicans on a $600 billion tax hike, $60 billion over 10 years. The same week, that was the first week of Obama's second term, the House and Senate passed the cleanup of Superstorm Sandy. One storm, $60 billion. In other words, one storm ate the entire tax increment for that year.
Hmm.
Pleasure,
you know,
John.
People have admired your career and the way in which you shifted from a traditional journalist to really someone who tries to see deep within problems, deep within transformative dynamics in the earth, and not reduce them, but produce handy little islands for us to grasp onto. The world is flat is an example of that. And, you know, put the Friedman engine to work on this problem here. How are people in different parts of the world going to have handy anchors and hooks to grab onto to collectively deal with this kind of thing? I mean, that's the challenge that you've really embarked on here in this documentary.
You know, no question, John. People ask me why I went into journalism, and we all go into this business, you and I alike, for different reasons. And I went into it because I love being a translator from English to English. I like taking complex problems and trying to break them down so I can understand them and therefore others can understand them as well. And I think that, you know, the biggest image I could use as a takeaway from the documentary I did on human migration from Africa is that we're really seeing a new divide in the world emerge. It's the world, the main geopolitical divide is no longer east-west, north-south, communist-capitalist. Really, the main geopolitical divide now is going to be between the world of order and the world of disorder. And you're already seeing that take shape with the Mediterranean, now one of the main dividing lines. because we've seen these refugees flowing out. Most people think they're from Syria and Iraq, and some are. But, John, close to 80% are actually from Africa. And they are, you go into these villages, as we show in the documentary, and they're basically no men between the ages 18 and 60. They have all left because climate change has reduced the ability of the land to produce food and jobs to sustain these men. And at the same time, their populations have exploded.
See, this is what's so exciting about talking to you here, because what you've just described there is one of those anchors. When we talk about immigration, we need to think of it as an environmental issue, not as some political issue. That's really the way in which we're going to reformulate. I mean, it's a Noah's Ark kind of thing that's happening.
There's just no question about it. And one of the problems you have, you know, if a Syrian is abused by their government and knocks on our door, that person has certain legal international rights as a political refugee. If an African who is abused by nature knocks on our door, by the way, natural forces, which in many ways we contributed to, he or she has no rights, because there's actually no international convention for migrant refugees, and yet they're going to be the biggest group cohort in the world.
Tom Friedman is columnist for The New York Times, a correspondent for the National Geographic program Years of Living Dangerously. First episode of season 2 aired last night. His upcoming book is called Thank You for Being Late. Thanks so much, Tom.
Pleasure, John.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Stand-up comedians are in the business of making us laugh, but not everyone is technically a stand-up. Gert Schuster, for example.
No, I'm a sit-down, because I'm too old to stand.
Schuster is a 95-year-old comic who didn't take the stage to tell funny stories until she was past 80 and had just emerged from a coma. Many decades before, she had also survived the Holocaust, and she advises the rest of us to enjoy life. So, Gert, do you think most of us take life too seriously?
I think if you laugh more and fret less, you'd have a better life. Because we fret about things that usually don't happen.
Were you someone who, when you were younger, had ever wanted to be a performer of any kind?
I started in school because of one of my teachers who knew Reinhardt, the Reinhardt School, where most of the famous actors used to go there in Vienna. And I spent a week with Reinhardt, and it was an experience that I've never forgotten. One of the most important things to remember, Mr. Reinhardt used to say, is remember there are no pearls on the ground. That means you don't look on the ground, you look up. And another thing is you don't hide an elephant center stage. That means if something goes wrong, you gotta cover it, because the audience is gonna know it. And you better cover it, or else you got egg on your face.
You know, Gert, I'm not sure if you've heard this, but a lot of people will say that many of the funniest comedians we have are those who have the most pain, who've gone through the most painful things, and certainly during the 1930s and 40s, you went through some very painful things. Would you mind telling us about how that affected your life?
There's no use in dwelling on it. It's better to dwell on the good things and hope for the best than to anticipate the worst, because it's going to happen. If you don't, sometimes you luck out and you come up on top.
Do you consider this to be kind of a Renaissance period for you?
I guess so. I have a good friend, and she's pushing me to write a book. It will be vignettes. I mean, like, funny things happen. When we first came to London, of course, we didn't speak English, so we had our little dictionaries, German, English, English, German. And and we were on the bus, and the conductor came, and we realized that my friend Anne's husband was on the upper deck because he was wanting to smoke. So we were looking in the dictionary very quickly, and we came up with the Lord is above, because Herr can be man, mister, all different kinds of things. We picked on the Lord is above, and the conductor looked at me and said, well, that's true, but he's not going to pay your fare. So the man sitting across the aisle said, that was worth all the money in the world. I'll pay the fare.
Do you have a radio-friendly joke you can tell me?
Yes. Jesus went walking around Jerusalem, and he saw his reflection in a store window and realized that his toga was real raggedy. So he went to Moshe the tailor, and he said, I need a new toga. 3 days later, the toga was ready. And Jesus said, how much do I owe you? And Moshe said, well, you're the Son of God. I can't charge you anything. Tell people how satisfied you are with my work. Maybe I'll get some new customers. A week later, Jesus happened to pass by Moshe's street. There's a line going around the block of customers. He says to Moshe, what's going on? He said, you must have told the whole town. Everybody's coming to get things done, and I bought the building next door, and in gratitude, I'll make you my partner. So from now on, the building will say, Moshe the Tailor and Jesus. Jesus said, you know, I hate to pull rank, but I am the Son of God. I need to have top billing. He said, it should be Jesus and Moshe the Tailor. He said, let me think about it. And the next week was the grand opening, and there in big golden letter across the front of the building, it said, Lord and Tailor.
When you've done your shows, you've dealt with all sorts of different comics, and I would guess all of them are younger than you are. Do you ever offer advice? Do they ask you for advice?
Yes, there's one thing that I try to tell them, and that is, take your time. That's the most important thing in comedy. Don't rush it because you're going to step on your own joke.
How does the audience respond to you?
You know what? When I perform, I feel like I'm sitting in the living room with my friends. And that's the feeling I have, and I think that's the feeling they get from me.
That's 95-year-old sit-down comedian Gert Schuster. More people, many of them millennials, are moving into downtowns and density is increasing, but others are leaving the concept of traditional suburban life behind for something that isn't in the middle of the city, but does feature very close neighbors and communities. They're categorized as co-housing areas, which involve private spaces with shared facilities. Brian Stark lives with his family in the Milagro co-housing community in Tucson, and he joins me. Brian, why did you decide to move into co-housing?
Primarily because we wanted to live around and know our neighbors, and we had lived in more traditional neighborhoods, and co-housing offered a much different view of that, an experience where you are interacting with your neighbors on a regular basis, and that was attractive to us.
Yeah, why was that important to you and your family? Because for a lot of people, we hearken back to older days, and they say they want that, and most people don't make the choice, though, to find a new place that fits that.
Sure, exactly right. Unfortunately, a lot of our neighborhood design has moved toward the individual owner, where you drive your car into your garage or carport, you go into the nearest door, and you close the door. And that's the extent of your relationship with your neighborhood. And some people go 20, 30 years without ever knowing their neighbor's name, their next door neighbor's name. And what happens in this situation where you have an injury and you need some help, or your child care fell through and you can't find someone to watch your kids? And those things happen to everyone on occasion. And so among that and other many reasons, co-housing offers a wonderful alternative to all of that, where you know your neighbors, you can lean on them in times of need, you can offer your help, and you are interacting with them in their lives, celebrating things, consoling each other, and it's just a different way of living.
Can you describe how different it was from the previous life you led and the previous place your family had lived?
Absolutely. There's basically six common traits that all co-housing communities aim for. And the first one is they are private residences with shared facilities. So you own your home, you live in your home, you can do anything you want in your home. But if you want community, you just step out your door and it's there. The next is intentional neighborhood design, followed by participatory development process. And we also have resident ownership and management. We have an equal say or an equal voice in the community, and no shared economy. So those are kind of the basic six tenets of co-housing. And where I live in Milagro co-housing, we follow all of those. And you'll essentially see a size of a neighborhood design in most co-housing developments across the country, somewhere between 20 and 40 homes. And if I were to borrow some familiar verbiage that people might have heard before. Co-housing, I would say, is a type of residential construction that's designed and built by the people, for the people, and actually at the location of the people.
Does it feel as though the people who live there have to have more in common than just wanting to live in a co-housing environment? You know, we often think about one of the reasons people don't talk to their neighbors as much is because, well, I don't really want to listen to what that person has to say. I've got my own things, and I want to go watch my TV and whatnot. I know I'm pigeonholing, I'm stereotyping, of course, but is there any of that? Or when people make a commitment to live in a situation like this, they are open-minded to, not total agreement, of course, but open-minded to the way people think, and they may be different thoughts.
Great question. Well, we are not a utopia. We do not always get along. We have differences, and we have a process for working through those differences. And because every decision is made by consensus, it's okay to disagree. But consensus doesn't mean everyone agrees. It means everyone can live with the outcome. And we have a significant process we can go through when we're making hard decisions within the community about how we live in our shared spaces. And that process has worked well for us.
Now, when was the last time you either borrowed the either proverbial or real cup of sugar from your neighbor?
Last week, actually. Okay. My daughters and my neighbor's kids love to bake, and we're always running out of something. So they run from one house to the other. And if they don't have the thing we're looking for, we can just put an email out to the listserv and somebody will chime in. Usually five somebodies will say, oh, I got that. Come on over.
Brian Stark of Tucson's Milagro Co-Housing Community. So what are the distinct advantages of co-housing, even if it's not for everybody? Bella DiPaolo is a social psychologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's the author of How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century. Bella, how much of the co-housing popularity has to do with being able to rely on neighbors and not feeling out on one's own?
Co-housing is wonderful for that. So in co-housing, you have people who want to be in a neighborhood that's neighborly, that actually is neighborly, so that people care about each other and are interested in each other's lives. And yet, co-housing communities also offer a measure of privacy, too, because each person has their own, as part of their own household. So because these houses are usually clustered around a common space, they're in a neighborhood that's designed to be neighborly, there are other people around. So if your car breaks down, you need help with babysitting for your kids, or just about almost anything that can happen, some help is just a few steps or a text message away. And that is something that people in co-housing communities just love. They call them co-housing moments when something happens, maybe, you know, like that infamous commercial, I've fallen and I can't get up.
Right, of course.
In co-housing, you just bang on the door and bang on the floor and somebody hears you downstairs or upstairs, or you get in touch with somebody else in the community, and there they are at your doorstep.
Well, so how many living choices then do you think we make almost out of a sense of nervousness, a sense of the unknown, a sense of fear, almost like when we buy insurance, even though we may not need it?
I think of it differently. I think that for a long time, we just sleepwalked into living choices. Like, of course, you go and get your home out in the suburbs and you stay there. And now I think, for a growing number of people, choices about how to live are much more deliberate. So you can think about, do I want to live with other people? Do I want to live by myself? Do I want to live by myself, but in a community of other people? And there are so many new and creative and innovative options for ways to live that I think we have more possibilities now than ever before for people to find just the right life space, I like to call it, that suits who they really are.
So are there any pitfalls, do you think, that we have more choices, that we can do co-housing, we can live by ourselves in the suburbs and whatnot? Are there any things that make you potentially nervous?
Not me in particular, but I think there are people who really were comforted by the predictability of the one life path of getting married, having kids, staying married, retiring, having grandkids. They, something about that predictability, knowing that if you follow that path, then all the pieces of your life supposedly fall into place, and there's some comfort to that. There's some attraction to that. And so there's always backlash when a lot of alternative possibilities crop up.
Bella DiPaolo is the author of How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century.
There are some people who believe in ghosts, and there are some people who don't.
God, it knows I'm here.
Are you a ghost too?
There are no such things as ghosts.
Ghosts.
Goats?
Call them what you like. Ghosts, spirits, haunts, phantoms. October is the time to share their stories. There are the classic scary stories we share over the campfire, and the surreal stories we share about our own encounters. Today is Zarco Guerrero. He's an artist in Phoenix who creates masks, including colorful skulls that are popular on the Day of the Dead holiday, which starts tomorrow. It's a time to invite the spirits of one's ancestors back to the world of the living. And for Guerrero, a connection with spirits started at a young age.
I grew up like a lot of people. I grew up attending church. I grew up Catholic with that worldview, a Catholic worldview of life and death. But at the same time, I was living a parallel experience with my father, who was an archaeologist here in the Valley. And he himself was somewhat obsessed with our indigenous past here in the Phoenix area. The house was full of artifacts, arrowheads, pottery shards, sometimes full pots, axe heads. Growing up, I actually saw graves of those indigenous people, of the Hohokam, and finding these magnificent little treasures. You know, an arrowhead that could be maybe 800, 1,000 years old. Who made that? How much time, how much care did they put into it? That gave me the feeling that this object that I was holding in my hand was infused with the life force of the person and the people who used these objects. So I think that's when I begin to develop this consciousness that the past is not the past. The past is still with us. The celebration of Dia de los Muertos is totally opposite the celebration of Halloween, even though they fall almost the same time of year. A lot of people get them both confused. I hear people say it's a Mexican Halloween. But Halloween is something that evokes fear. On the other hand, Dia de los Muertos, we build offerings or altars, as some people call them, to welcome the spirits of our ancestors back. We want to entice them to come back. And so we do that by creating a space in the home dedicated to that person or those people by making their favorite food. That could be their favorite drink. It could be a soda pop, or it could be a bottle of tequila, candles to light the way. And we talk about them. We mention their names. We recite poetry that they've written or anything that evolves around them. We bring those out into the open and we remember them. Juan Gabriel, for example, was a pop star in Mexico, but he was much more than that. Yes, he will be missed and grieved forever, but he'll never die because we have his music. And you can be sure that this year at Dia de los Muertos celebrations all over Mexico, all over the Southwest, you're going to be hearing the music of Juan Gabriel.
Abrázame que el tiempo es oro si tú estás conmigo. Abrázame fuerte, muy fuerte y más fuerte que nunca. Siempre abrázame.
The central image in the celebration of Dia de los Muertos is the smiling, highly decorated skull. We call it the calaca. When we put on the calaca mask, or if you paint your face in a calaca mask, you are being able to let go. We're letting go of our ego. We're letting go of our flesh. We're letting go of our pain. We're letting go of all those things that bind us to the earth. An important thing to remember about the celebration of death in the Mexican culture is the element of humor. The Day of the Dead skull is happy, it's vibrant, it's decorated. It gives us the opportunity to look death in the face, to smile back at death, and literally and metaphorically, we get to dance with death because at the festival we're surrounded by masked characters. When we accept death as an integral part of life, we think we're losing our fear of death. But really what we're losing is our fear of life, of living a full life. Even the dead arise enough to dance.
Tucson musician Sergio Mendoza is known for his loud, high-energy, sweaty live shows and for creating a sound that incorporates elements of music from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. His band Orquesta Mendoza is currently touring in Europe and is releasing a new album called Vamos a Huarachar, which comes out November 11th in the U.S. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with Mendoza about his new record and how growing up on the border influenced his music.
I was born in Nogales, Arizona, but then I was raised in Nogales, Mexico. For the kind of music that we play, we try to incorporate different cultures and traditions from both sides of the border. My experience here in Arizona, it's been mainly positive living here. You know, as I grew up, I never thought of people in colors or race. And there's been certain situations in Arizona where certain people have made me aware that I am Mexican and that I'm a little darker. And overall, I wouldn't describe Tucson as a racist place or try to promote it like that in any way. But, you know, I've had experiences and that's what makes you who we are, you know.
So do you in some ways see your music as reactionary to the politics that are happening around you, or are they just incidental? Is it that you're making this music despite whatever is happening in the world around you?
I mean, when I lived in Nogales, I think it was more like making music for making music, and that's where it starts. But the more I tour the world with other bands, with Calexico or Divachka, these are bands that are aware of social issues. And for me now, I want to be more aware of what's happening in my city, in Tucson and Phoenix and in my state. And it's only from experiences that now the themes of the songs have a little bit to do more with these topics like race and my feelings about that.
Can you point to maybe a couple of songs on your new record that you feel like are reflective of some of those themes?
Well, track number 2, it's called Redoble, and that's a song that, it sounds like it could be a party song or it could be like a good dance number, but it's mainly about my experience with seeing racism. And so the song is called Redoble, which Redoble means drum fill in Spanish. And it also says Vamos a Huarachar, the album title. And the way I look at that is, drum fill leads you to the next section in the music, but I'm kind of more referring to a change in the way things are here. And Vamos a Huarachar is kind of like an invitation to anybody in our state to come in and dance with us and to come and celebrate different cultures coming together here in Arizona.
For someone who has never been to one of your live shows, it's a pretty incredible experience. Like, I almost feel sometimes when I have stepped into one of your shows that I'm stepping into a different place or maybe a different time. You're all wearing suits. You're set up on stage, maybe kind of like in the way a big band would have been set up in the 40s or 50s. Everyone's dancing and moving and sweaty. How do you create that energy on stage at your live show? And then how do you translate that kind of intense energy where you're feeding off of the crowd onto one of your studio albums?
Well, for the live shows, if it was up to me, I would have 15 musicians all dressed the same and looking sharp, you know. I think that's really important for me to present it that way, in the way of a band from the 1940s with the big band stands and everything. Then as far as the energy of the band, for this record that we just made, Vamos a Huarachar, we constructed the songs in the studio. It wasn't a band playing all these songs together. It was recorded in sections. And so I think it's hard to really represent the sound of the band in the studio. But then at the same time, I think it's really cool that we make these studio versions, and then the live show has a lot more energy and it's different than the studio album.
One of the things that I think is so appealing about your music is that it comes from so many different places. You can hear so many different styles as part of it. You can hear cumbia, you can hear mambo, psych, rock, you can hear so many different things. Did you grow up listening to all of those styles of music, or did you come to them later?
Well, I've been into many different styles of music throughout my entire life. And then, I mean, there's styles that I didn't like when I was a little kid and I like now. But when I was little, I mainly started with the traditional border music, you know, there in Nogales, Sonora, which included a lot of cumbias and rancheras and, you know, all the traditional styles like Ramon Ayala, Los Tigres del Norte. Those are some of the first melodies I started to learn on keyboard when I was 5. And of course, I discovered the Beatles right around the same time. And then, you know, when I came to Nogales, Arizona, I started playing with musicians who were, you know, born and raised in Nogales, Arizona, and they got me away from Mexican music. And to them, it was like, even Mexican television, they were like, why are you watching Telemundo, or why are you watching, you know, it was like, watch this channel in English and listen to Led Zeppelin, Police. So then, I mean, from when I was like 11 through 18, it was just all American music. And then when I was like 23, I started playing salsa. So I joined a salsa band, and I did that from like 24 to 27. And salsa was actually like the connection that got me back to loving Latin music, because I had been away from it for a long time. And after playing salsa, I wanted to go back to what I heard when I was a little kid, which was mambo. And that's what led to me starting Orquesta Mendoza. I mean, this new record, it's a combination of a lot of things. Of course, with Latin rhythms overall. But there's references to the Beatles, to the Zombies, and to all the bands that I like.
That's Sergio Mendoza talking about his band Orquesta Mendoza's new album, Vamos a Huarachar, with KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. The album comes out in the U.S. on November 11th. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.